Hey, has lichen sclerosis messed with your relationships? You know, partner, family, friends, even at work? Then you need to join us at the Holistic Healing Summit this May 13th to the 17th, because we're bringing all the experts. We're going to be talking about intimacy, sex, as well as how do you talk to your family, friends, provider, boss? All of those things. And this is a free event, live, virtually, so you can catch it anywhere in the world, May 13th to the 17th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. We've got sessions going on all day. Get more information at lssupportnetwork.org/WHS. That's lssupportnetwork.org/WHS.
This information is for educational purposes and is not medical advice. Speak to your medical professional before making any changes to your care.
Welcome, everyone. I am so, so excited to have this conversation with our guest today, Sophie Reese. She is a researcher in England, and she is actually working on LS research at the moment. She's close to the end, but she's working on a project called Living with Vulva LS, a Mixed Method Study. And she is a sociologist, and so she's using the sociological approach to understand the experience of living with LS, which, hallelujah, someone is telling our story. So thank you so much, Sophie, for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And thanks for the introduction.
Oh, absolutely.
Very all about amplifying voices and, yeah, hearing about people's experiences and thinking about how we can use that to make positive changes.
Okay. I want to say thank you, first off, for even doing this research, because I will say 2022 has been the most research around LS. Like, there has been a real ramp up to LS research, which is great. It's amazing to see all of the research. But I will say, with all of the research, what do you hope to be the outcome of your research, right? Because I've seen research in the past that has said LS affects the mental health. We need to be sending people to counseling when they get a diagnosis. I've seen all of that research, but it's not happening. So what do you think is going to be different about your research, or what do you hope it's the difference as far as like the outcome?
Yeah, great question. Well, I think, so one thing that I set out to do was to really go in depth into that experience and try to uncover things that maybe haven't been talked about before using the social science approach. And then something that I'm doing at the moment, I'm developing an animated video, which is going to be a tool for health professionals. So the idea is it's like an educational tool, and it's based on the interviews we did. So it's going to have actual voices, not actual voices, but actual text, like based on the actual text from the interviews. We've kind of smushed some characters together, made some characters out of a few different interviews. And the idea is that, because the key message we got was that health professionals don't understand this disease, they don't understand like the impact it has on us, and therefore we're not getting access to diagnosis and we're not getting optimal care and treatment and follow-up. So I really wanted to do something which would actually target health professionals and say, like, this is literally how it feels based on the interviews, and really raise awareness. Hopefully that will come out early-ish next year, and I'm going to take it to conferences and try and get it into like curriculum. I think it's really important. It could be like useful for medical students and getting them early so they can understand and hear about this condition. But I think you're right. I think that is actually something I was thinking about that's a real challenge for research in general, is how we get it out there and how we actually make a difference, how we make an impact. Because like you say, there's so much research going on, and my research is very much about amplifying those voices and thinking about how we can improve people's experiences if people understand actually what it's like to live with it. And there were a few other things. Part of my study was looking at how people's attitudes towards treatments. So I was looking at people who were already on proactive therapy in Australia. So that's going to be really useful, I think, to think about what actually helps people stick to their treatment and what are the things that might maybe are obstacles that we might need to address. So that kind of thing, like a bit more practical kind of things I've been doing. But yeah, so it's a tricky one, though. Trying to get some real impact from research can be really challenging, especially my type of research, which is more like in deep understanding of what it's like to live with the condition. And I think the stuff that you do, Kathy, is amazing and totally inspired on Instagram, like trying to share my findings and reach health professionals. And it's challenging, though.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Because I will say it's frustrating to us. Mm-hmm. And we've actually had a discussion around this in the LS Warriors, how we have this research coming out saying how we're feeling, but we already mm-hmm. know that, and it doesn't make a difference. It's like, really, mm-hmm. do health professionals really not understand how this affects us? Do they really not think that, hello, this is affecting us mentally, sexually, mm-hmm. physically? It doesn't take a genius. Oh, so totally, why, these are really smart people. Why mm-hmm. are they not getting it?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think it's really frustrating. I mean, I kind of think more research into like treatments, supportive things, everything is really useful. But I kind of think what we need is like a really massive public health campaign, which is mm-hmm. not what I do. But I would love to get involved in one. But something that really raises awareness globally. I think we've talked about it before. Like, we need somebody famous to come out and say that they have LS and get the conversation yes. going. Because if you look at other conditions, disease like breast cancer, that's what happened back mm-hmm. in the 80s and 70s. You couldn't talk about breast cancer, and then you have like people like Betty Ford coming out and say, wait, am I saying that? It's Betty Ford, wasn't it? Somebody famous came out, and I'm thinking back to my undergraduate now, but someone famous came out and said that they had it and kind of raised the profile of it. And I think that's what we need with LS as well, in a way. It's just those mm-hmm. voices that have power.
Yes. And we are looking for that. We are looking for that voice. So if you're listening, hit me up.
I think. And it's all wrapped up in issues we'll talk about today around stigma and lack of understanding of the vulva in general.
Oh, yeah.
About the vulva.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been saying from day one, we need to elevate vulvovaginal conditions, not just LS, because I've mm. found out over the last 2 years that there's so many other conditions that are just as minimized as LS that affect the vulva, and we have to raise awareness. That there's no reason that I should reach my 40s and have never heard of these conditions, and not even like what quote unquote rare conditions like lichen sclerosis, but just other things like BV and there's just other things that can happen to the vulva that are not talked about. And the education just needs to be better. And it is all about breaking that stigma. We're hitting that hammer hard. Lichen Sclerosis Support Network is just, it's a sledgehammer. It's like one of those power hammer things. Like, we are just like, we're a jackhammer. We are not, okay. we don't shy important. Away from it. We are all about vulva power.
I had women in my interview saying, I didn't even know I had a vulva until I got this diagnosis, right? So I think that's a key message, is that women are coming out, coming seeking help for something that they can't even put into words where it's hurting, or they can't accurately describe it to healthcare professionals. And so healthcare professionals and awareness amongst the public about, and education amongst the public about the vulva. I mean, you always think like maybe things are improving, and in the future, maybe girls are like learning more about themselves and about their bodies now than previous generations did, but not quick enough, is it?
No. So research takes a long time, right? I think I don't think a lot of people appreciate how long an actual one really good study can take. So really quickly, can you just like go over the just broad strokes of from beginning to end, what it takes to do a real quality research study?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm kind of thinking about in the medical context. So even though I do social research, I work in a medical context. and I have been on plenty of grant applications for research projects and worked on plenty of research projects in the medical context. So usually, like, you come up with an idea, you spend months like developing it with your colleagues, building the right team, making sure you have who needs to be on, all the kind of right expertise, the mix of expertise that you need in your team. And you start the process of writing a grant application. You have to identify, okay, where can we get funding from? In my context, it's usually something like the NIHR, which is it's called the National Institute for Health Research in the UK, which is the biggest funder of medical research. Other people might be different. They might go to like commercial sources of funding. And then you have to develop an application, which is really massive piece of work. It's like a full-time job for like 6 months, sometimes longer, almost. Like, you're just kind of constantly drafting, redrafting, thinking about all these little issues, trying to really get all the issues pinned down. And then you apply to a deadline, to a funder, and then usually have to wait several months before they consider it. They have like meeting where they consider lots of different applications, and it's a competitive process. Then they come back to you and say, well, often they say, we're not interested. but then hopefully they will say, we're interested, but we think you should change this and this, or you need to address these issues. You write another application, and like a second stage application, which usually has much more detail, and you're addressing kind of issues that they've raised. And then so this is just the part of getting funding. I'm probably going into too much detail, but yeah. Wow. So then eventually, hopefully, you get the funding, and then you start it. And then obviously, setting up a study, like if you're doing, for example, like a clinical trial, which is probably the type of research that your listeners are really interested in, is like comparing different treatments, right, or treatment mm-hmm. against placebo, then that involves like a really big process of getting, like, figuring out, okay, where are we going to find our participant? You know, is it going to be from hospitals? Is it going to be from primary care? Finding those people who you have to train to recruit your participants, getting them into the study, and then, of course, however long the actual, so say you're testing, I don't know, a treatment for 3 months or something, or 12 months even, you get them into the study one at a time, they dribs and drabs in over months and months. You might be open to recruitment for 18 months, 2 years.
Wow.
And then you do the analysis. So it is, yeah, it's, I think as an outsider, it's so confusing, like how it takes so long. But maybe that gives you a little bit of an insight into the kind of work that goes in. It's incredibly expensive and resource.
And then once you do the analysis, right, which could be like following these people for a year, and then... Yeah. And then you have to take all of the results, mm-hmm. figure out what is it saying, and yeah. then come to a consensus with all the other researchers, right? Yeah. And then yeah. write the paper, absolutely. The long paper with all of the information, yeah. and then try to get that published, right?
Yeah, and that can take a really long time. I think it's especially challenging if you have a study that maybe doesn't show that this fantastic treatment works. If you have like what's called a negative study where you found that it doesn't help or it doesn't make any difference, sometimes it can be challenging to get that published because it's not as sexy and exciting as like, oh, this new treatment works, right? So you can go to like several different journals before you actually find one who will publish it sometimes. So yeah, it's a long, old, drawn out process. And if you think about it, the analysis happens from when the last patient who entered the study has finished the treatment and has reached the sort of point at which you can collect that data and do the analysis. So yes, it's usually you're talking 2, 3, 4, 5 years of the study overall. Wow.
The whole yeah. thing.
Yeah, and probably 6 if you're adding on all the applying for funding at the start and everything. So it really depends on the study. But
right.
if you're talking like the type of studies that I've worked on tend to be what we call pragmatic randomized controlled trials, which is when they happen in the real world, so in the real health system. And so it's not kind of like a super controlled study. It's like happening, being delivered in general, like what's happening in normal life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you need a lot of patients, a lot of participants usually, and it can take a long time to get that done.
Yeah. And kudos to you. Like I said, this is not an easy process. I mean, yeah. And then at the end, you're like, okay, I've got this amazing study. I've got these results. Now the real work is, how do I make how do I incorporate these results to create change? Because I think that every research is really is conducted so that it can for the betterment of the patient, right? Mm. Is it a better treatment, a better diagnose, a way to diagnose another, a better outcome once you are diagnosed? So all of that then has to be disseminated into the public so that there can be real world changes. Mm. So along the way, imagine there's a lot more pitfalls that can actually happen as you're going along. So what are, like in your study, what are some of the things that you had to overcome? Because you're in the last stage of your actual, the study itself, right?
Yeah, so my mixed methods project, so that one is looking, so we did qualitative interviews, lots of different interviews, focus group, and then we're doing a survey at the moment. So yeah, we started that at the end of 2020, and it's supposed to finish in about 2 months, 2.5 months. If I start about talking about kind of one of the big hurdles, I guess, in starting research, which is like, where do you start and what do you research and how do you kind of convince a funder that what you've chosen to research is important? So in 2018, I was involved in something called the Priority Setting Partnership, which was a project led by Roz Simpson at Nottingham University to look at what are the top priorities for LS research. So we wanted to know the whole community, so patients and their carers, like maybe like if they have children with LS, including them, also like health professionals and researchers. And we wanted to know what are the top priorities for research for these different stakeholders and for the whole community. So we followed this method, which probably don't want to go into detail of, but eventually we came up with a list of top 10 priorities. I think actually we have 20, but the top priority was the best way to prevent and manage anatomical changes caused by LS. So that was something that came out as, actually, I think that was really reflected in my interviews with women, because I think this issue of scarring and anatomical changes is really upsetting, distressing, and like nothing that women have ever encountered before. Mm-hmm. And they're often not told about it. They find out about it through like talking to people on support groups and things. And so it really was something that affects everything, right? How you feel about yourself, quality of life, everything. So I think I was really pleased that in my research that really reflected the top priority. So I think, but people might want to go and have a look at that, those top 10 lists, because I think it's really interesting to see. It kind of sets the scene maybe for research that's going to happen going forward. So what, because there were lots of other things in the top 10, from whether patients should continue using steroids even when there aren't any signs of disease activity, to the best way to diagnose and the best surgical treatments and these kinds of things. So I think it's kind of really useful for us as researchers, because then we can go to a funder and say, look, this is something that is seen as important to the whole community. So for me, for my research, for example, I could say the impact on quality of life was one of the kind of top priorities for the community. So I went and said, look, I think it's really important that we actually have a good study exploring what it's like to live with it. So that's kind of like one thing that people have to overcome, I guess, when they're kind of thinking about starting research in LS. And I think another challenge is the lack of interest in LS. And we've sort of already talked a little bit about it's wrapped up in the kind of stigma and shame around LS. But so, for example, I looked on the clinicaltrials.gov website earlier this week, which is a website where people should be registering their medical research in general. And it's a really like important place because it makes things transparent. You can see what's happening, but it's probably not like there's probably loads of stuff happening that isn't registered on there, but it's a good place to start. And so when I searched for lichen sclerosis, I found 39 results. So there's obviously been more than 39 studies on LS. But then if you look for something like erectile dysfunction, for example, I got 563. Mm-hmm. So 14 times more studies registered on erectile dysfunction than on LS. So that just sort of gives you an idea of the kind of scale that we're talking about and how far, if you like, in a way, how far back in the field we are in terms of like developing research in the area and getting interest in the area. So it can be really challenging to get your research funded when there's this lack of awareness, lack of knowledge, poor understanding, and really just an absence of conversation about the vulva and vulval disease. So in the UK, for example, the government just published the Women's Health Strategy, which is for England, kind of like the things we need to do to improve women's health and tackle health inequalities between men and women. And it's all great stuff, but the vulva is just not there. It's just silent again. And I think that, so I kind of use that as ammo, like this is an issue, like it's silent again, but we think it's important. We need to bring it into the conversation. So it can be really challenging. I think things are improving. So like you said, there's a lot more research. And in the UK, we've just, the NIHR, that really big funder, has just commissioned a big, really big piece of research comparing proactive versus reactive steroid treatment. So we can talk about that in a little bit maybe. But so I think that's a really good sign that that means that they see it as important. And like you say, more and more research is coming out. But yeah, it was quite interesting looking at that registry actually, Kathy, because I looked. So there's research, maybe I'll do like a pop quiz. There's research on there from 2009 to the present day. And you're probably well aware, but so this includes research that hasn't actually started yet. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think was the kind of most studied intervention for LS according to that registry?
I would say as a overall or just recently?
Overall.
Overall, steroids. I think the use of steroids. But if you said recently, I would say laser treatment.
So I guess I should have clarified that it's from 2009. Like, I think that's when the registry probably, when people started registering stuff. So yeah, from 2009 to now, you're right. Laser was like the top one, or
laser,
high energy based devices. Yeah. So yep. that's more, I think it was more than half of the studies I found were about laser. And when you look at the ones that are coming up, most of them are laser.
Yeah. Which is interesting. And I'm glad, because there are a lot of people pushing laser as a treatment or even as a cure for LS, which is frustrating on our end as far as the nonprofit, because the research is not there yet saying, yes, this is conclusive, this is good. As a matter of fact, it's only more leaning the other way, but people are still selling it, like, and we have to combat that all the time. And it's kind of that misinformation. Who has the biggest bullhorn, right? Who's making the most noise and getting the most attention? So once we get the definitive answer that, let's say, laser treatment is not effective, right? It's symptom relief. It's not the managing the condition. How then do, and I won't say us because we're the patients, but how do you, as the researcher and the providers, how do you combat these other practitioners from selling it as a cure, as a treatment? Because there are lots of them. So how do you do that?
It's a really good question. It's a really big challenge, isn't it? I think when you have, like you say, I think when you have a condition like LS where there isn't a cure, and perhaps a lot of people are unhappy with what's offered by the kind of mainstream health providers, you get opportunity for people to be exploited, unfortunately. And we know that, and people, you'll probably hear people saying that it's worked for them, and it's same with PRP, right? That it's worked for them, it's wonderful. But we also know that when people pay for something, that they're more likely to feel like it's worked, right? Because they get such a strong placebo effect, and because they paid for it, they value it highly. But I think how we combat that, it's so challenging. My first thought was actually we just need to offer good care in in the mainstream setting. So I think, you know, if we had good care, then people wouldn't be driven to, I don't think there's really been research done, and I would like to I think it's kind of, a lot of my research is like stating the obvious, but like, why are people driven to these kind of practitioners? It would be really interesting to explore that. And I think, and then you can therefore think, okay, well, this is what we need to do to make sure people have the right information, to make sure people have the right care. Because I think if it's taken you years to get diagnosed, and then you're offered steroids, and you're sent away with very little information, and then you see adverts on the internet for this wonderful treatment, and you can afford it, or you can scrape together money to do it, then I don't blame people for doing it at all, I think. But yeah, I think going through channels like yours, where you have a big reach, social media, I think, is really important for putting out countering messages about these kinds of treatments and the kind of truth. Something you said I wanted to pick up on, the definitive answer. I think it's a real challenge with things like lasers and even PRP, because there are lots of different kinds. So like getting the definitive answer, quote unquote, is going to take a really long time, because someone's going to come along and say, ah, but you didn't try this type of laser, or you didn't try this protocol with the PRP. And it's probably going to go on for a very, very long time. And yeah, there was a good high quality study done showing that probably laser is helping with urogenital atrophy and those kinds of symptoms, but probably not for LS. And if you do go and get laser treatment for LS, you do need to keep using your steroids. It's an adjunct treatment, exactly. Not an alternative. Yeah. I should also say a disclaimer, I'm not medically trained, but this is my interpretation of the literature, my understanding of the research.
I want to say too that with you saying it's going to take a long time, and totally get that, because look how long it took for steroids to become the gold standard. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm looking back on the research, and it wasn't, if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't that long ago that testosterone was used as the treatment. And then steroids had to be put up against all of these other treatments and studied over and over and over and over again until it came out on top. It was shown to be safe. Mm. It was shown to be effective. And so that's how it's now the gold standard. But from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, steroids have been researched for 50 years now, right? Since the 1970s for LS.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're continuing to be researched.
Right.
Because I think the consensus generally is, and what you see if you look at like clinical guidelines around the world, that steroids are recommended and seen as the thing that works. But we don't have agreement and consensus on how often to apply them, and what dosage, what type of steroid, what dosage of steroid. So that's still an ongoing conversation. I think that's the point that we made at the start, that this is such an early field compared to these other conditions, that it must be, I know it is so frustrating that we don't have the answers to some of these things, but at the same time, the research is happening. Like we said, it just takes so long. And for a reason, you have to make sure that you're doing research well and you're not rushing things. So yeah, I think it has been studied for a really long time, but I think like I say, like we're starting a big study in 2023 comparing, like I said, proactive with reactive therapy, which some people might think, well, isn't that already decided, we already know what's the best? But actually we have what's called community equipoise. So although you might have individual clinicians who are totally convinced that you need to use them all the time no matter whether you have symptoms or not, some clinicians think that's too much burden, unnecessary, there's adverse effects. And not everybody is convinced, and we don't have good enough evidence to put into clinical guidelines yet either way. So I think that study I'm really excited about personally. I don't know how much it's going to excite you and your listeners, but I think it will be potentially quite dramatic if we can get it into guidelines.
I think that's going to be a really important study. I know you and I have had an in-depth conversation on this, but just so for my listener, so the study that she's talking about is going to look at whether we need to have a maintenance dose or whether it's using it as is will be the guideline. Because right now there's kind of, it's up in the air, right? Some people are told use as is, some people are told about the maintenance dose. And even though at LSSN, we've done the unofficial study, and we know that when people get onto a maintenance dose, the quality of life is so much better. We know that we can stop the progression of the condition when we're on a maintenance dose. So to actually have the data that says that this study has been done, this is, and you can take this to your doctor, and we don't want to hear any more bullshit about steroids thinning the skin, it's not good for you. No, this is what I need, and this is the study. Because right now we do have Dr. Gail Fisher's, that big clinical study, but it wasn't that was not the reason for the study. That wasn't they weren't looking for that conclusion. It just so happened that was like a byproduct of that study. And so I think going in with, this is the answers that we are looking for, this is the question that we are asking, and let's just see what the answer is definitively. I think it's going to make such a big difference. So that study is just getting started, right? So what phase are you in on that study?
Well, we've secured the funding. So we're at that stage where we haven't actually started setting up. So next 2023 is when we're going to be setting it up. So we'll hopefully be recruiting. So once you've got the funding, then it, like I said, it's a case of setting up the site, and you have to get ethical approval. So every study should be reviewed by a proper ethics committee. And that can take quite a long time, a lot of back and forth with, I think you should change this and that. And making sure we've got everything really right before we start, because we don't want to get halfway through and think, oh, we wish we'd done it this way. So spending some time really thinking through the practicalities, making sure we've got everything right. But yeah, I think we'll hopefully be starting to recruit patients something, I don't want to commit, but something like September next year, hopefully, starting to recruit patients. So, and that is going to be a, I think we're following them for 2 years in total. So primary outcome is in 1 year. So number of flares of, we're hoping it will show either way. It doesn't matter what I think, because I'm not a clinician and I'm not treating these patients. I do think hopefully we will show that there's a benefit to doing it. And like you say, just have that answer. I think it'd be really valuable to just have the answer either way, whatever we find.
Right.
And yeah, hopefully you guys are happy with it. But yeah.
So just to put it in perspective, you've done the funding. How long did it take you to get, like, from the start to this point where you are now?
Good question. So I was living in my old house. So when did we start? I think it would have been, what year is it? 2021, we would have started putting the funding application together.
So 2021, you started. 2023, September 2023, you're going to be starting to look for participants. So that's 2 years. Then you're going to be following them for 2 years. And then, so then the study will be over. Then you'll start analyzing the data. So yeah, that might take another year, maybe.
We'll do analysis, primary outcome analysis at 1 year.
At 1 year,
so
okay.
1 year, but we will follow them up for another year afterwards to look at things like scarring and for like malignancy, like cancer. But yes, so yes, that's right, 1 year.
So another year.
And then we'll do the analysis.
And then you got to write it up, which I've actually was following a researcher who the study was over. She did the whole write-up and I'm like every month, are you done? Are you done? I'm ready. And it was actually for the placebo, the laser placebo. Okay. And I've had her on the podcast, Leah Mitchell. And I'm like, are you done? Are you done? And that took a year. And she's like, okay, it's finally getting ready to be published. She's like, I finished writing it. Now we had to wait for it to be published. So let's just say another year. That's a total of 5 years from the beginning of conception to the very end. And this is important. So we have to wait another 3 years at minimum till we have that paper that says this is the result. This either everybody should be diagnosing maintenance, or everybody should be diagnosing or giving telling people to use it, recommending. Thank you, recommending to use it as needed. And in that meantime, there are thousands of people who are in this process who are up in the air. So it's so frustrating, but I think, like you said, what we can do in the meantime is educate. So getting that information out there, get the podcast, the website, social media, getting that information out there, because we are making a difference in the meantime. But you keep doing the work that you're doing, because it's so important.
Yeah.
It is really so important. So we started talking about some of the hurdles. When you're going now, so of course we know the hurdles as far as like getting funded, that it's like applying for like a college, right? You apply for all of these colleges and hopefully you get an acceptance letter from one or two.
Yeah.
Or it's probably even harder than that. But now you're to the point where you are getting ready to, you're setting up the research, and now you're going into actually getting participants. What are some of the hurdles that you now have to overcome or that you overcame with your current research that as far as like getting participants, and what would you say to encourage people to participate? Because it's scary.
Yeah. Great question. So in terms of things we've had to think about, so I'll come back to the point about encouraging people to participate. But I mean, one thing is finding the right patients in the first place. This is going to vary by health system, but I don't know if it's the same in the US, but in the UK, people are seen by so many different types of providers, gynecologists, dermatologists. They might just be managed in primary care, so with their GP, their family doctor, or they might even be seen in sexual health clinics. So like actually finding people with LS is a real struggle. And kind of connected to that, I guess, is we don't really have a good handle on how many people are actually affected by LS. And to be honest, it's really hard to do that because, well, it'll probably be an underestimate however many people we find, because people don't seek help for a really long time, or they're misdiagnosed with other things when they do seek help. So that's kind of a big challenge for us, with thinking like, so how are we going to actually find? Because normally you say, right, we're going to go through GPs and we're just going to like send a letter out to everyone who's registered with as having LS. Or you might think, oh, we'll go to like specialist clinics, because those people will definitely have LS because they've been seen by the experts. Because the risk, obviously, with going out to primary care is you get people who don't actually have LS and things like that. So that's a really big hurdle, I think, really challenging. Because, and especially because like funders always want to know, like, how many people are affected by this? How many people's lives are you going to change? Like, who does this matter to? How many people does it matter to? So that's like one challenge. And I know that so Roz Simpson is working to develop a checklist of diagnostic criteria to help in primary care people accurately diagnose LS. And I think that's going to be sort of aimed at.
Wait, time out. I don't know what you're talking about. So that's interesting. What are they developing?
Yeah. So she's working on, it's her study. I'm not like totally up on it, but she'd be a great person to speak to actually. So she is developing a checklist of diagnostic criteria. So basically, because not everybody can have a biopsy, not everybody wants a biopsy. Biopsy isn't necessarily the best way to diagnose if for most people, right? Because they don't want one. So they are looking to think about, how can we speed up diagnosis in primary care? So when somebody comes in with vulval symptoms, how can we make it quicker that they, if they have LS, that they are diagnosed? So a tool basically that will help health professionals in that context properly diagnose people. I think it's also aimed at patients. So patients who have symptoms can use it and think, okay, I think I have this. It's going to be a well-evidenced checklist criteria, because I bet like the LSSN has something like that as well, right? But this is going to be, So this will be like working with clinicians and experts to like make sure we have a really rigorous, well-evidenced set of criteria to help people diagnose themselves and help primary care professionals diagnose patients. Does that make more sense? Sorry, I did.
That is amazing. No, thank you. That's something new. And the doctor's name was what again?
It's Rosalind Simpson. So I think Jacqueline commented that, she does the CORALS project. So that was looking at the core outcomes.
Yeah.
So that's something else I was going to talk about. But
that is awesome. Yeah, we don't have a checklist only because, like you said, the research is not there. Mm-hmm. And there's so many overlapping symptoms with other conditions that right now there's, as far as like what we can say, what the research shows is, it's not there yet. So for there to do that research, for us to then be able to say, here it is, that would be freaking phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Yeah. Because we do biweekly virtual meetups. And in this past meetup, we had two people in the meetups who their symptoms were right there with LS, but then there were other symptoms that were like, those are clearly not LS. And they were like, this could be like in simplex chronicus. This could be some other vulvar condition. And outside of getting a biopsy, there's no real way to know. Mm. But these people one of them had been diagnosed with lichen sclerosis, but the steroids was not working for them. It was irritating them. So which to me was like, Okay, there's a sign. But then she was resonating with this other lady whose biopsy had came up with lichen sclerosis chronicus. And she's like, maybe I need to look into that. And it's so having that checklist would be so, so important.
Yeah, differentiating between those very similar conditions.
Yes.
And so I've just helped write a paper. Well, it's not been accepted yet, but hopefully it'll be published, which is about, it's just like a clinical practice article, it's called. So it's trying to like kind of educate primary care, people in primary care who might be seeing these women. And like, if you see a woman who comes in and she has these symptoms and she's been in before and she's had negative swabs for thrush, seriously consider LS, do an examination. And if you're not sure, refer. And that's kind of like, that's come out of my interviews because so many women were saying to me, I went back over and over again and I kept getting negative swabs for thrush, but they still gave me thrush treatment or this kind of thing. So I think that's one of the biggest issues is the access to diagnosis. And
I think the other issue too is it's that the old research, and I am seeing newer research correct this, but it's going to take time. But the old research was saying how this is for prepubescent and postmenopausal vulva owners. Yeah. But here's the thing. There's this whole spectrum of reproductive age people in the middle who have LS, and we are getting overlooked until we hit menopause and then we get the diagnosis.
Yeah.
So I'm loving that the fact that all of the research that I'm seeing coming out recently is stating this can affect any age. Mm. It's not just prepubescent and postmenopausal. Look at your reproductive age patients as well. Don't dismiss them, because that is a huge population of people who say, I went to this doctor and they say, oh no, you're too young. And then I hear this all the time. I told them I want a biopsy. And then, oh, when the biopsy comes back, oh, it is lichen sclerosis. And if I wouldn't have advocated for myself, then I would have not got my diagnosis. Mm. And here's the thing. When we go to the doctor, we are trusting that this person knows what they're talking about, that they know what tests to run, that they know the information that they need in order to correctly diagnose us. So for instance, I never did a Google search until later on into my diagnosis on what this condition is. And I don't think that I'm abnormal in that I trusted the doctor.
I think you're right. I think a lot of people still feel like that. And it's often that attitude is often kind of like, oh, that tends to be like the older generation that trusts the doctor and don't question things. But I don't think that's true.
I think that's true at all.
You are putting, you're very vulnerable in that situation. You're talking about something that we've already said is sometimes impossible to verbalize because you don't have the words. It's excruciatingly embarrassing sometimes to verbalize it. And then you're the most vulnerable you can be in that situation. And you are putting your trust in the doctor. And it's so, and I heard from women who were saying, I had to like arm myself and march down there, arm myself with information and march down there and demand, like you just said, demand a biopsy, demand an examination, for goodness sake, the most like basic thing. And it shouldn't be like that. It should be, you're taking, I'm not saying everybody who goes in with itch should immediately be examined and sent for a biopsy. Totally not. That would be impossible for GPs to do. But if you're going multiple times, let's start to take.
Well, they should be examined every time. There's no reason you should not go into exam. Right. There's no reason you can go. You should go to the gynecologist and you leave out of there without ever having your pants off.
Sorry, I'm thinking about primary care specifically.
Yeah.
So, like,
okay.
Where they only have like 10 minutes.
Left. Yeah. So I want to ask you, as far as like your research, are you including trans and non-binary folks in your research? Because I know you're saying you've talked to women, but are you talking to the LGBTQ community as part of this, are your studies?
Yeah, I'm really glad you called me up on that, actually, Kathy. Thank you. I tend to use women because it turned out that all the people that took part in my study identified as women. So it's just kind of like shorthand. But I do, when I like present it and when I publish, I use inclusive language, and all of our study materials for my study were gender inclusive. So I said people are assigned female at birth, but also you know, anyone basically with a vulva could get vulval LS. So we made sure that our recruitment materials were all gender neutral. So we didn't specifically like say women in it. We said women and other, I think others are non-binary. I can't remember the exact wording now, sorry. But yes, the short answer is yes.
Okay.
We didn't reach, so I did go to a trans research partnership and they did put some information out about the study, but we didn't end up reaching anyone who was trans in the main study or non-binary in the main study. But one of the sub-studies we did was focus groups with on a slightly different topic, but still LS. It wasn't the kind of like in-depth lived experience interviews that I did. And we did have one trans woman in there. So that makes me feel like what we did was good. We were inclusive in our language, but it's such a small group of people who A, have LS and are trans or non-binary and are willing to be interviewed and would happen to see our advert. But I do think that's a really big issue and really needs exploring, the issues of non-gender conforming people when they have a vulval condition. How on earth they navigate services and care and treatment is a whole different study, I think, that needs
Oh my God. I get the emails and it's unfortunate the way that they're treated, and it's on a whole nother level. So yeah, it is. And so part of your study too, then I want to do as far as like the participants, and when you think about writing your results, were the participants mainly postmenopausal, or did you have a big group of reproductive age?
We had a wide range. And it also included people who knew that they had had it since they were children, whether they were diagnosed or not, but or just kind of reflecting back, thinking, I'm pretty sure I had it. Yeah, so we had a really wide range of people. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I remember the exact ages now.
Good. Yeah, because I know Dr. Kraft is doing research to show that, hey, this is not just prepubescent and postmenopausal condition, that she's showing that. And going research into pregnancy, which I think is also pregnancy and LS is so under researched.
I think there's loads of, I also tried to reach women of color and we managed to include a few, but not enough. I think that's the whole issue. Sometimes it might take them longer to get diagnosed because of like whether they get examined in the first place, whether it gets recognized, maybe further complicated. And then there's also cultural issues potentially, or just, there's lots of issues that are unexplored. I think we haven't looked at the experience of children or adults of children, parents of children with LS. That's a whole other issue as well.
Yeah, there's so many avenues of research that need to be done. But like you said, we are in the infancy of research. Eventually we will get there where we're like breast cancer and we have like the thousands of research papers going out. When we're looking at getting participants to join studies, how would you encourage people to do that? Because it can be scary. I mean, I've had a conversation with Leah Mitchell a while back on all of that it intakes, and you are really possibly putting your health at risk, right? So what do you say to people?
And that's a challenge, the ethical issue of potentially, if you're looking at treatment studies, withdrawing, you're essentially withholding treatment if you're saying use a placebo, they shouldn't know. But that is a risk that you could, some studies require a washout period, so you have to stop taking your steroids in the time leading up to it. What would I say to those people? So I would never try and persuade. I think that's really important, actually, that I think people should know the value of research, but they should also know the risks. But I think what I would always do, we have to do this, the ethics committee requires it, is that we inform patients as well as we possibly can. So they are giving informed consent and they understand the risks and the benefits. And I think most people need to know that when you do research, when you go into a study, it most likely is not going to benefit you, but it might it should hopefully benefit people further down the line. And I think for a lot of people, that's enough motivation. But then with something like LS, where it's scary to come off your steroids potentially, or to try a scary new treatment that involves having a laser on your vulva, like, probably isn't the most appealing for a lot of people. Yeah. The most important thing is just to inform them and help them understand what they're getting involved in. But I think also what we've talked a lot about today is like making sure that our findings get put out there, because it's so unethical to do research and then not publish it or not make sure that people know. If we're doing all this research on lasers, especially, I feel like something about me just makes me think, oh, lasers, it sounds so like painful and like scary. We're doing so much research. So many women are having it done in the name of research. We need to make sure those findings get put out there as quickly as possible. I think that's a responsibility. So I'm not sure if that really answers your question, but I think you've given me something to go away and think about, like, in terms of making sure that our results go out there. Because even taking part in an interview where you're sharing your experience with me, I was so grateful to the people that took part. I think it's my responsibility to get the findings out there as much as possible.
Research participants are superheroes, because they are looking at the greater good. Like you said, it may not be helpful to me, but it's going to be better. It's going to help the greater good, right? The most people. So, and researchers, you guys are superheroes too.
No, the participants way more. Right, I'm going to think about it in that way.
So, going back to research that's needed, I think it's really important that at some point there's some research on what the different symptoms are for people of color. Because I will say, and I've heard this in other people as well, is the symptoms aren't exactly the same. So for instance, I didn't have the white waxy skin. My skin got ashy. And I didn't really see that when I'm looking at the symptoms. Ashy vulvas is not a symptom. The white waxy skin is, but my vulva is darker color. So my vulva is brown, like a darker brown. So where is that? So I think
So maybe, do you think the symptoms are different, or is it more the kind of visible clinical signs? Is that
I don't know. I don't know. That's something that needs to be researched. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think too, it's like we need to know. Because this is something that's just not in just LS. This is throughout the whole medical system is that a lot of the research is done around Caucasian people. So like totally off topic, but it's correlates because, for instance, the oximeters that read our oxygen levels, we put it on our fingers and it reads our oxygen levels. Mm. There's research now showing that it does not accurately monitor, or what is it? Not monitor.
Like
in
darker skin, it's like not as accurate.
In darker skin is not as accurate. So I can tell you, like, for instance, for my husband, when he was coming home, and for those who are if you're listening and don't know, we caught COVID in September of 2021. And ended up in the hospital. I was in for a week. He was in for a month, and he had to be intubated twice. When he finally came home, he was still on oxygen. And we are relying on this piece of equipment to let us know how his blood oxygen levels are. Mm-hmm. And even though his levels would read in the normal range, he was still gasping for breath. And it's like, it wasn't until I've happened upon this research that showed that this thing may not be reading his levels correctly because he does have darker skin, that it was like, okay, we need to also supplement this. We can't just take this as a grain of salt, because it's not built for African-American skin. It's built for Caucasian skin. So I just think it's something that as a researcher and moving forward into the future, that something we keep in mind that these studies are not just built for Caucasians, that if they need to be separate studies, then so be it, but it needs to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a conversation I've heard a lot in terms of research now, especially funded by the NIHR in the UK. It's more and more they're asking, how are you going to be inclusive? How are you going to include different groups of people, including by ethnicity, etc.? So I think I do see it as something which is growing in terms of awareness. I'm not sure we have all the answers yet, because I think we often feel like we're doing a lot, and yet the participants we're seeing are mostly white. So I think, but there's a lot to be done, maybe in terms of like improving communication with different groups, improving trust, like the way that we approach people maybe needs to think about. But there's definitely a lot of work to do there. I agree with you, Kathy. And I know we definitely had those conversations when we were designing the trial that's starting in 2023. But it's kind of like, it's like we can have these conversations. We'll have to see what the actual outcome is.
Right.
But yeah, I agree.
What would you say would be the top three hurdles as far as getting a study done, like from start to finish? What are your top three, and how, if there's a way, as patients, what can we do to help?
Ah, brilliant question. I mean, I was going to say, so your first one is that it's so competitive and getting funding in the context of lack of awareness, lack of interest. And I was actually going to say that I think part of the reason that my research got funded was that I had a really brilliant patient advisory group. So they were a few patients I got in touch with, brought together. We had a couple of conversations. I asked them to read my study design and comment on it and send me comments. And I actually included quite a few of their verbatim, so actually what they said in the application. And I think that really helped, because it showed this is coming from a place that patients consider important, people consider important. And it was quite powerful, the kind of things they said as well. So I think just getting involved and sharing your views on people's research is really important. So if you see any opportunities for getting involved, then like really, really do so. Pushing for more research. I think the more research we have, it'll kind of snowball. So like mm-hmm. if you have like a field of people doing research in it, then they'll get funding and they'll have a good track record and they'll get more funding. And then it's kind of like, you're more likely to have like really good breakthroughs in treatment and things. So more and more. So I guess the top one is obviously getting funding in the first place. The second one, I think, is finding participants. I was really worried that nobody would want to talk to me about their LS, but in the end, I was overwhelmed with responses. But in the survey where I'm going out to primary care, that's a different story. It's hard to get people to respond to the survey because maybe things are okay for them and they don't have a lot to say. So that's like another issue. So I think if you get invited to be in a study and you can spare the time, please do. But obviously that's kind of like a, I recognize that not everybody wants to or can. And then what would be my third one? I mean, I think, what would be my third one? What else? What is another hurdle? There's so many. I mean, I think you have to have so many conversations and making sure you have the right people in the room with you having those conversations. And so few people know about LS. I felt like when I was trying to put together a team to do a study, it's like I'm having to educate everyone on LS. So not much that patients can do about that other than be like a vocal voice, ask for research. I think probably just asking every time you see your doctor, and is there any new research? Because maybe then if they get asked to be involved in research, they'll think, oh yeah, I will do that because I get asked about it all the time and I can tell them something next time. So
what about sharing research with our doctors?
Because you become the expert, don't you?
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of doctors who they don't have the time to research everything. And then if they only have two or three LS patients in their practice, that's not something they're going to be spending time on, you know? So if you are one of those two or three and you're like, hey, this new piece of research came out on LS. Have you seen it? Here's the link, or here I printed it out for you.
I agree. I think that's great. I would like to start doing that myself to doctors. But I think, really important. I think a lot of research, you said like more and more research is coming out. I think a lot of it is, in a way, it's like pioneered by patients coming in and being like, you need to look at this, or like, I think this, have you thought? And just like having that involvement is so valuable and so important. And I think research wouldn't get done without their input. So I think it's super, you have a really important place, not only as participants, but as, like you say, disseminators, so sharers of that information back into the healthcare system even.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and another thing, I think it's researchers working with organizations like Lichen Sclerosis Support Network to get the information out there to the patients, because we, as lay people, we're Googling, it's not really coming up. Like the old research that's been getting lots of hits already, it's coming up, but the newer research that has the current information, it's not as up in the rankings because it's newer. And the people are not looking at it. Yeah, it doesn't have that. Yeah. So I think having that relationship would definitely help people to. So doing podcasts like this, thank you so much for being here, because it does. It's going to continue to help grow that. Is there, and maybe there isn't, but is there a central place where people who want to be participants in research that they can go and just put their name in, and then if a research study comes up that they're already in that database?
It's tricky. I can think of specific. So for example, in the UK, there's something called the ZOE study, which I think it started as a COVID study and now it's become like a repository of people who are interested in research. I think that's just the UK, though. I'm not sure if that's international. That's a good question. I don't think there is. But I think, because often when you're doing this research, you have like such a specific exclusion and inclusion criteria that you tend to think, well, we'll just find them through their doctors. Mm. I think what you could do, though, is contact research organizations or even societies like the ISSVD, that is the International Society for the Study of Vulvovaginal Disorders. Mm-hmm. And they probably could do with having like patients come to their conferences and hear about research and find out opportunities to get involved, maybe not as participants, but like as helping to make sure that like the patient facing materials make sense and aren't inappropriate, or making sure that the studies that we're designing will be acceptable to patients and things like that. So there's lots of ways to get involved beyond being a participant yourself. So, and that's really good, I think, because if you're like not really sure if you want to be a participant, but you're passionate about research, there are other ways to get involved. I talk to your providers, because they might have patient groups where they go to them and say, we're thinking of doing this research, what do you think? So yeah, just ask.
Awesome. Thank you so much for just coming and sharing this with us and giving us a real life point of view of what it's like to be a researcher, what it's like to get a study from start to finish, and some of the hurdles that you overcome, because it's a lot, man. You guys, yeah, but here's the thing, like you're one person, this is one study, and you have to go through so much. So we just need a lot. We need to multiply you like by 1,000. And
I'm not the only one. I think the main thing I want people to take away is the research is happening and people are really passionate about it.
Yes, it is happening. But as we talked about, it is a slow process.
Yeah.
But the uptick of research that came out in 2022 has been amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's going to continue into 2023 and beyond. So we have arrived, people. LS has made it onto, it's a little blip on the screen, but it is on the screen. And we are going to keep that circle growing and growing, because y'all know I got a big mouth and I'm going to continue to grow this platform, and we're going to get even more and more attention. So thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you. If
people want to reach out to you, how can they do that?
I think Instagram is the best way. So I'm on Instagram, Dr. Sophie_Reese_researcher. I should maybe make that catchier. What do you think, Kathy?
I think it needs to be a little shorter. Yeah. I
just a suggestion. Yeah, okay. I'll work on that and I can update it. But any suggestions, send them my way.
Okay. So I will have her linked in the show note. I will also have in the show notes the link to the top 20 priorities. Topics. Yeah, priorities for research. So you can go and look at that. And once again, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Kathy. It was great.
Awesome. Thank you.